We're on? Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Just as a little bit of a preface to today's class, you will often find all kinds of profound messages delivered at these classes, lifted from many books and many ideas that kind of mesh together and present you with a bigger, more profound, a deeper picture that is not the purpose of tonight's class. Sorry to disappoint you. This class is no mysticism, no philosophy, no kidding. Okay, you're just going to get the straight facts so you can do the Seder right. And the reason we're doing this series of classes is because so many people want to do the right thing, and they sadly don't because they just don't know any better. Now, there's what I would call the bare modicum, just the minimum of getting done what you have to do on the night of Pesach, and that's not that difficult. But if you're doing it, you may as well do it right, as you will hear this evening. So I hope that you'll all leave here with a sharper understanding of what you're supposed to do and a better ability to carry out the Seder in order to fulfill the mitzvahs of this very special holiday properly. And of course, when we fulfill all of the observances of Torah and mitzvahs to the best of our ability, we are immeasurably enriched. Cameras notwithstanding, I do encourage you to ask questions tonight because you need to know the answer. So if something's not clear or if there's a question that comes up, please interrupt me. I'll repeat the question and I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability. We good? Ready to roll? Okay. So I'm going to begin this practical overview of the Seder before the Seder. But I want to give you a little bit of background first, just so you understand why we're dealing with this in the manner that we are. The Seder is an evening that is highly orderly. In fact, the word Seder means order. And everything that happens at the Seder happens at a particular time, in a particular place, and in a particular way. And whilst some of it may seem superfluous or unnecessary, it really isn't. It's really all part of a very, very tightly choreographed program. The Seder can't begin before it's night. It can't begin in the afternoon. And I'm going to talk about that in a few moments. But that's where the first halacha about the Seder is that you should prepare the Seder and all of its intricacies before Pesach arrives, which includes setting the table, which includes making sure that everybody knows exactly where they're going to be and how they're going to be, so that the moment we're able to start, it should start without delay. Why? Well, here's the paradox. On one hand, the most important actors at this event are the little children. This is our opportunity to pass on the tradition and the legacy that has been received by each and every one of us in an unbroken fashion, going back to our ancestors who actually left Mitzrayim. You know, people talk about archaeological proof. What would you like to find? Moses' Seder plate? Like, how would you know what it is anyway? There's no more compelling proof than we, the Jewish people, who have done this year after year after year in an unbroken fashion. And regardless of which community you'll be at, the Seder doesn't really vary that much. It's essentially more or less the same thing. Slight variations, slight nuances, slight details, but essentially the same exact thing done by Jews who lived incommunicado for as long as two millennia. So on one hand, the children have to be up. So if the children have to be up, what's a good time to do it? When the children are usually up. On the other hand, we say it has to happen at night when the children are usually sleeping, which creates a paradox and creates a challenge. Although maybe it makes this night special and different for the children, because children love to stay up almost as much as adults love to go to sleep. And because they stay up that one night a year, that's why it's so special and it leaves this indelible imprint on their minds and hearts. But the Shulchan Aruch does say that the table should be set from Erev Pesach, when it's still during the day. Everything should be in place. And the reason is that miyad, immediately, kishatechshach, when night falls, you should be able to begin the Seder. So why do we usually welcome the Shabbat early? And why won't we do that on the night of Pesach? So let me give you a quick overview. The day and night are comprised of 24 hours. Now, in today's day and age, most people function by the clock. And the clock has 60-minute hours that are basically equal. You have 24 of those. That's what fits into the full cycle of night and day. And to be sure, this is twice a year in the spring and in the fall where the day and night is exactly even. You have exactly 12 hours in each. When you have exactly 12 hours in each, you will get 24 equal segments. But that's rare. And what usually happens is that either the night gets longer, the day gets longer. And when the day or night gets longer, we, from a halachic perspective, continue to divide the day into 12 equal parts, and we continue to divide the night into 12 equal parts. And that will mean that the hours of the day or night, depending on whether it's summer or winter, will be longer or shorter. This is called in Hebrew, sha'ot zmaniyot, which means timely hours. Hours that depend on what time of the year it is. Now, let's say for argument's sake that we're talking about a perfectly balanced day, a 12-hour day. When would day begin? Once again, for argument's sake, we're going to say at sunrise. So day begins at sunrise. Day will end, for argument's sake, at sunset. Sunrise, sunset. I'm not alluding to the song, but sunrise, sunset. Okay, this is your two poles. Okay, here we are. Here's our sky. The sun is rising. So the sun rises, and the sun continues to rise higher and higher and higher from our perspective until it reaches the apogee from our vantage point, and we call that noon. In Hebrew, it's called chatzot. Chatzot means
half,
which freely translates as noon or midnight, depending if it's day or night. It means half. So you take the 12 hours, you slice it in half, that gives you 6 hours during which time the sun was constantly rising. Sun starts rising, continues to rise. Then it reaches the apex. What does the sun start to do? It starts to set. So when does the day start to end? The answer is at 12:01. Sounds kind of ridiculous because it's right in the middle of the afternoon. But in theory, the sun has begun its descent at 12:01. So once the sun begins its descent, afternoon sets in, and we're now moving towards night. In Hebrew, this is called this time, the time of afternoon, meaning from when the time is at its high point to when the time sets, this entire gamut, this range of 6 hours, is called Bein HaArbayim, between the setting. From when the sun starts to set to when the sun actually sets. So if Bein HaArbayim were to be divided in half, since it's a 6-hour program, how many hours would you have? 3 hours. That's the natural time for mincha, by the way. The mincha service in the Beit HaMikdash, the morning offering was brought just at daybreak or prior to daybreak. The afternoon offering was brought at what's called Teisha Sha'ot Bayom, 9 hours in the day, which means from sunrise to noon is 6 hours, another 3 hours, the division of Bein HaArbayim, dividing that in half, gives you 9 hours. That's approximately. So in theory, if the sun is rising at 6 and setting at 6 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at 3 p.m., that's what we call Mincha Ketana. That's the time for Mincha, the ideal time for Mincha. That's when the offering was brought in the Beis HaMikdash. Bidiavad, if somebody would daven Mincha from after Chatzot, you would still fulfill the mitzvah, because once a year, that afternoon offering was brought several hours early. Why? Because we had a lot of work to do on that particular afternoon. You know which afternoon that was? Erev Pesach. And we have thousands of Paschal offerings to be brought, and therefore we needed the entire 6 hours, just about. So we daven mincha early. And because of that, once a year, you can pray your mincha service any day of the year, somewhat after Chatzot. Not exactly at Chatzot, but somewhere after Chatzot. So the last 3 hours of the day is really where, you know, it's the last quarter of the day. We're moving towards night, right? Everybody understands that. Mincha? You can take this 3 hours, this little slice of the pie, and you divide it in half. Since that period is called Mincha Ketana, the last quarter of the day is called the Mincha, the smaller time for Mincha, if you divide that in half, the halachic timeline is called then Plag HaMincha. Plag HaMincha means, in Hebrew, plag means to divide. Lefaleg means to divide, to cut. So if you divide the mincha in half, we don't want to call it chatzot because then we get it confused with noon. So we call it plag ha-mincha. You cut the 3 hours in half. Cutting 3 hours in half will yield you an hour and a half. That hour and a half before the sun sets is kind of like night already. It's like night's almost here. And because night's almost here, we can do things that usually you would only do in the evening. because it's almost evening. For example, on a regular basis, you can daven the evening service. You can daven Ma'ariv from after Plag HaMincha. On Friday afternoon, you can welcome the Shabbat. You can make Kiddush or light candles from after Plag HaMincha. You can't light candles before Plag HaMincha. If you light Shabbat candles on Tuesday, it doesn't become Shabbat. It has to be in the right time. The only time, the time which is, shall we say, available for sanctification, a time which is susceptible of being modified through our activities, is the plug, from the time of the plug. So for the last hour and a half, which incidentally could be an hour and 50 minutes, or could be an hour and 10 minutes, depending on which time of the year it is, that will vary because it's timely hours, that last hour and a half is what we will call sanctifiable. You got that? So why don't we just do that on Pesach? If we can do Friday night all year long early, why don't we just do it early on Pesach? And that would yield us at least an hour and a half ahead, or maybe even 2 hours ahead, of when we're going to begin the Seder, which is when it's dark, and hey, you would be able to do it an hour and a half before the sun goes down. It would make a lot of sense. But it's just not what the Torah says. Besides, other than that, it's perfect. Why? What does the Torah say? Not because you can't sanctify Pesach. You can sanctify Pesach. And in theory, if you were to light candles, it would be Yom Tov. If you were to daven Ma'ariv, the evening service, it would be Pesach. But you still wouldn't be able to begin your Seder. Why? Because on the night of Pesach, we have a biblical mitzvah of eating matzah. Ideally, the matzah should be handmade by a Jew who believes in God and his Torah, and that way it's called matzah mitzvah. It's holy matzahs. It's matzahs which are made for the intent of a mitzvah. Just like you understand that a mezuzah cannot be written by a computer or shouldn't be written by somebody who doesn't believe or somebody doesn't have the special ability to sanctify, just like you understand that the most effective robot still can't make kiddush for you, so too the matzah, which is made by a machine, is not going to have that added holiness imbued. It wasn't made by a Jew who believes in Hashem, who imbues it with spirituality. So the matzah that we're going to eat on the night of Pesach, when should it be eaten? So the Torah says, Be'erev toichlu matzahs. You should eat the matzah at night. So you're thinking, what's the problem? Matzah at night, that's great. We start the Seder. Till we eat matzah, we're almost like an hour and a half into the Seder. It will be right on time. Right on time, but not right. Because all of the mitzvahs of the Seder night are juxtaposed to matzah. We know this because it says that the matzah should be eaten al matzot umerorim yochluhu, that the matzah should be eaten together with the bitter herbs, together with the Korban Pesach. And since it's a mitzvah to eat Korban Pesach, and since the mitzvah of Korban Pesach is juxtaposed to matzah, and since matzah can only be eaten at night, when can we eat our Korban Pesach? If we had a Beis HaMikdash. At night. When can we eat the maror? Which incidentally, in today's day and age, is only a rabbinic mitzvah because it's supposed to be eaten, the three of them together. Matzah, meat from the Korban Pesach, and the maror. That's the only time the Torah tells us about eating maror, is when you have, together with the matzah and the Korban Pesach. In today's day and age, we don't have a Korban Pesach, so the maror we eat is only done in a symbolic fashion, and it's a rabbinic mitzvah. We make a bracha. It's a mitzvah like lighting the menorah on Chanukah. It's a mitzvah like listening to the Megillah on Purim, like washing your hands for bread, and we'll talk about that mitzvah soon. It's a mitzvah. It's ordained by our sages. So the notion of the mitzvahs of the night of Pesach are all likened, juxtaposed to the matzah. And just like the matzah has to be eaten at night, the maror has to be eaten at night, the Korban Pesach would have to be eaten at night. What else do we do on the night of Pesach, which is ordained by our sages? We drink 4 cups of wine. And since the 4 cups of wine are a unique mitzvah, which is especially ordained for the Seder, for the night of Pesach, so it becomes one of the mitzvahs of Pesach. If it's one of the mitzvahs of Pesach, it's automatically juxtaposed to matzah. If it's juxtaposed to matzah, if you start the Seder prior to nightfall, or if you drink the wine, if you make kiddush prior to nightfall, and you drink the kiddush cup, then it means you've drunk one of the 4 cups before the mitzvah applies. So you don't get the mitzvah of arba kosot. You don't want to do that. So what should you do on a practical level when you have all these people coming in and everybody in their minds starts a Seder at 5 o'clock in the afternoon? Simchat Gadya. I'm serious. Do all that songs, all the things in the end, which are just customary, if you have no choice, sing them before. Serve your Maxwell half a coffee before. Do whatever traditions are not actually mitzvahs, do those before. I mean, I'm not telling you to do that. Ideally, you should just start your Seder at night. But in the event that you have an issue, and you have a challenge, and you have a problem, and you have family, and people come fetching and complaining, so figure out a way to do things which are not mitzvahs of the night of Pesach, but just customary or just nice. The Kiddush should not begin before night. Everybody got that? Any questions about that? It should be crystal clear. There is no exception to what I'm telling you. There's nobody who's going to tell you, well, that's what the rabbi said, but you know, it's not really so. It really is so. That's the halacha. So if you're having a Seder, you may as well do it right. Because it doesn't work otherwise. You don't get the mitzvah otherwise. Mitzvahs aren't cute, quaint things. Mitzvahs are fulfillments of the will of Hashem, and the halacha are the strictures or the rigors through which we're able to fulfill the mitzvah properly. Okay. So that's the first thing that I wanted to clarify. Now the next thing I'm going to clarify, there's a lot of chapters here in the Shulchan Aruch that I'm going to skip. I introduced you to the beginning of chapter 472 in the Shulchan Aruch, and now we're going to go to chapter 473, and I'm going to jump around here talking about the things which I think are absolutely imperative for you to know and understand. One of the things that I've heard happens at a Seder is that it isn't so orderly, which means there's wine at the table, so people drink. There's stuff on the table, people eat. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about drinking. Is it like a nice little verbrengen? Everybody just drinks as he or she pleases. And if you want to knock back a little extra wine, what could be wrong with that? Well, it's actually really not so simple as you're going to hear. But before we get to drinking the wine, I want to talk to you about a special blessing which we tend to think of in terms of Kiddush, but actually it isn't. And this can happen when sometimes people forget to make this bracha, or somebody comes late. So I want to share the details of what's called the Shehechiyanu blessing. Shehechiyanu is a blessing in which we acknowledge and thank Hashem for having lived to this moment. Every day is a gift. Nobody knows what tomorrow will bring. When we are alive for a special occasion, we celebrate. How? By thanking Hashem. We make a Shehechiyanu. When a person arrives at an auspicious time on the Jewish calendar, the Torah ordains, the Halacha ordains, we should recite a bracha of Shehechiyanu. We should be grateful to God. Baruch Hashem, we've arrived at another Pesach. When should you make the bracha of Shehechiyanu? Or which mitzvah is connected to the Shehechiyanu? We have a lot of mitzvahs tonight. So you're going to make a Shehechiyanu when you make Kiddush, a Shehechiyanu on the matzah, a Shehechiyanu on the maror. You make a Shehechiyanu, and the Shehechiyanu is going to cover you. Now the Shehechiyanu for Yom Tov, the idea of making a Shehechiyanu for Yom Tov is that this time requires a Shehechiyanu. There are sometimes actions we perform that require a Shehechiyanu. There's a time that the time itself, arrival at this time, requires the Shehechiyanu. So when should people who light Shabbat candles, and all of you women, of course, will hopefully light Shabbat candles, when should you recite Shehechiyanu? The first time you do something which is connected to Pesach. What's the first actual observance of Pesach? First mitzvah? Lighting the candles. So when should you make a Shehechiyanu? The woman should make a Shehechiyanu when they light the candles. The men didn't light the candles. Or at least most of us won't be lighting the candles. If you're not lighting candles, when should you make a Shehechiyanu? When you make Kiddush. Now usually on Friday night, somebody makes Kiddush for most of the people who are assembled. But on the night of Pesach, everybody's got to drink a glass of wine anyway. So really and truly, there's no reason for everybody not to make Kiddush. Everybody can make their own Kiddush. Nobody has to listen to Kiddush. You can make Kiddush. You got to drink your cup of wine anyway. However, the woman will not recite Shehechiyanu. Why? Because you don't make a Shehechiyanu on the Kiddush. You make a Shehechiyanu on the time. You made a Shehechiyanu already. The men who didn't recite a Shehechiyanu yet will recite a Shehechiyanu on the Kiddush. But not because it's about the Kiddush. It's about the time of Pesach, which means that if Kiddush was recited and Shehechiyanu wasn't recited, when should you recite Shehechiyanu? Right away, whenever you remember. And the reason we recite Shehechiyanu the second night of Pesach is because outside of Israel, we have a rabbinic mitzvah to keep a second day of Yom Tov. So it's not the same as the first day. We recite Shehechiyanu for the second day of Yom Tov, which is of a different nature. And if you forget on the second night, when can you make the Shehechiyanu? For the next 7 days. As long as Pesach didn't expire yet. So as long as Pesach is still on, you didn't make a Shechianu yet, recite the bracha. So the mitzvah of Kiddush is a mitzvah. The mitzvah of Shechianu is a mitzvah. They are not interchangeable. It happens to be that for the men who didn't light candles, that's when the Shechianu gets made. But the Shechianu is not a part of the Kiddush. The Shechianu is actually a part of the day. We're observing the day. We're celebrating the day. It's not cute to make unnecessary blessings. So if you're reciting the Kiddush together with your husbands, don't recite the Shechianu because you already did that. But let's get back to the glass of wine. So the glass of wine, which a person drinks on the night of Pesach, and he's supposed to doing it, I've gone through these classes in the past, how large the glass has to be, what kind of wine you're supposed to be using, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to talk about that tonight. That stuff is already online. But what I want to talk to you about is, what happens if somebody wants to say L'chaim? He's in a good mood. It's Pesach. I don't want to wait till like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night to drink again. Let's drink. Could he do that? Does it happen sometimes? It does, no? Like people? So here's the thing. By the cut and dry of halacha, if a person would want to drink after Kiddush, or even kind of wet his lips in the middle of the Haggadah, by the cut and dry of halacha, it would be permissible. So if it would be permissible, why shouldn't we do it? Because actually, this is a good time not to drink wine so you can stay awake. The more wine you drink, the more tired you get. Usually people are tired. They work hard for Pesach. And wine makes you tired. So it's not a good idea to tire yourself out any more than you are already. And especially because we didn't start this meal till at night, and now we start drinking more wine, and the wine is supposed to have alcoholic content. It's not supposed to be grape juice. That's another story. So if you drink wine, there's a good chance you'll be more tired. Not a good idea. In other words, when you have a mitzvah to fulfill, niceties do not override the mitzvah. What's your mitzvah now? V'higadat ha-levincha. Now your mitzvah is to tell your children. You don't have children, tell each other. You have to tell your friends. You have to tell the story. Everybody's got to read the Haggadah. The Haggadah has to be verbalized, read. I didn't say you have to say every word of the Haggadah. I mean, you should, but if you didn't say every word, you still fulfilled the mitzvah. But you got to be speaking tonight. Tonight, everybody gets a speaking part. If it works better for different people around the table to read different parts and others to read along quietly, whatever works for you. But everybody's got to speak. Everybody has to verbalize. This is one of those verbalization mitzvahs. V'higadat ha-levincha is not a mitzvah to think. It's not a mitzvah to imagine. It's a mitzvah to say, to speak, to talk, to tell. The more tired you are, the less speaking you're going to do, or at least coherent speaking you're going to do. Therefore, the advice the Shulchan Aruch gives, now is not a good time to drink extra wine. All right, you say, fine. You almost ruined my Seder, okay? I was planning to drink all this wine. You didn't let me drink wine. I had to do a dry run. I got to get through the whole Haggadah, which is like so onerous. I finally got through to the Haggadah. I drank my second glass of wine. Can I have some more wine now? Okay, so it's not so simple. Now, once we finish the second glass of wine, which is after we recited the whole Haggadah, in theory, yes, a person could drink as much wine as he or she would want. However, it's still not such a good idea. Why not? Because now that we finished doing the mitzvah of telling the story, what's the next mitzvah? The next mitzvah is eating the matzah. The next mitzvah is eating the maror. And the hungrier you are, the better it is, because you're supposed to actually eat matzah with an appetite. And it's very hard to eat matzah with an appetite unless you're very hungry. So the more hungry we are, the better we have a chance of eating the matzah l'teyavin. Nonetheless, if a person really feels they have to wet their lips a little and two glasses of wine wasn't enough, it can be done. However, here is a very important proviso. If you're one of those people who needs to drink that extra glass of wine, needs to sip a little, listen carefully. Before we partake of food or drink, what do we as Torah Jews do? We recite a bracha. What's a bracha? A bracha is a meditation, a moment of mindfulness, an opportunity for us to become a little closer to Hashem and to acknowledge His kindness. We don't take anything for granted, including the food that we benefit from. So anything we have benefit from, we thank and acknowledge that it comes from Hashem, and coming closer to Hashem through recitation of a bracha, we're now able to partake of the food in an appropriate fashion. And that helps us to elevate the food and so on and so forth. So, if I recited a bracha, let's say Bori Pri HaGafen, okay, the bracha you make over a glass of wine, and I finish drinking a glass of wine, do I have to make another bracha, Bori Pri HaGafen, to drink a second glass of wine? No? Why not? Because Bori Pri HaGafen includes the wine you're going to be drinking. What happens if there was a bottle of wine on the table? Say it was Purim. So think to drink wine. There was a bottle of wine. The wine is gone, and everybody's kind of has a long face because there's no more wine. And somebody suddenly comes, and he's got a new bottle of wine that nobody thought of, nobody knew about. It was unexpected. What happens then? They have to make another bracha. Why? Because you didn't think about that, it wasn't there. Now, if I'm at somebody's home and the host brings out the extra bottle of wine, I don't have to make another bracha because I assumed that the host knows what he's doing. And he probably has got wine somewhere. He's probably going to be serving more food. So I don't have to think about what he has available. I don't have to check out his pantry before I make a bracha. If the host makes a bracha, he hosts a meal, whatever he's going to be bringing out that day was included in the bracha. But here, the wine wasn't there. Everybody knew it wasn't there. Somebody brought it. You have to make another bracha. So the upshot is that since the bracha is less of a verbalization and more of a mindfulness, I mean, it's verbalization too, but it's more of mindfulness, that mindfulness has to be mindful. You have to have in mind what you're going to be eating. So if you didn't intend to eat and you only made a bracha on what you were going to eat and you weren't intending to eat anymore, then you would have to make another bracha. Your bracha expires. Your bracha only works for what it was supposed to work, for what you intended it to work, right? Mindfulness works for mindfulness. So, because of this, in the event that a person were to clearly intend not to eat anything else, we would have to make another bracha. At a meal, what did you intend to do? You intended to eat. When you're home and noshing, as people do, it's not healthy, by the way, but people do that, you also don't have to make a bracha every time you reach for another potato chip, even if a half hour went by. Why? Because that's how people are at home. They make a bracha and they eat, they nibble. We are nibblers, noshers. That's what we are by nature. So because that's how we are by nature, when you make a bracha at home, you wouldn't have to make another bracha. If you leave your home and you went somewhere else, so a half hour ago I was eating some potato chips, and now somebody's offering me some more potato chips, I have to make another bracha. Why? Because I left that environment. When you leave the environment, you have to make a new bracha. These are the rules. This is the bracha rules. There's one big exception to this. On the night of Pesach, we drink 4 glasses of wine. Usually, same wine, same bottle even. And yet, sitting at the same meal, drinking 4 glasses of wine, we make 4 brachas of Bori Pri HaGafen. That's kind of strange. Why do we do that? And the answer, in a word, is because since each glass is a mitzvah, so as it's kind of to honor the mitzvah, we're not just making a Bori Pri HaGafen over the fact that I'm drinking wine, it's a Bori Pri HaGafen, I'm drinking wine as an act of homage to Hashem, as an act of love and loyalty and devotion and commitment of my Judaism. But I, as a Torah Jew, believe that I'm supposed to drink 4 glasses of wine tonight. And by the way, if you take all 4 glasses and pour them into a big tumbler, you don't fulfill your mitzvah. It's 4 glasses of wine. It's not about volume only. Volume plays a role. It's about 4 independent glasses of wine. So therefore, since they're at intervals, and since they have special mitzvah attached to it, I make an individual bracha. It's a very rare thing. It doesn't happen. Outside of the Pesach Seder, we would not do such a thing because we don't have any mitzvah to drink a number of different glasses of wine. Which leads us now into a very, very interesting situation. I made a Bori Pri HaGafen at the time of Kiddush. What was I thinking about when we recited the Bori Pri HaGafen? What was I thinking about? I was thinking about the glass of wine that I'm about to drink. Was I thinking about any other glasses of wine? No, but a second glass of wine, I know, I looked in the Haggadah, I cheated, I know. I'm going to make another Bori Pri HaGafen. So I'm not thinking about the second glass. And anyway, as we just said, you're not supposed to drink a second glass. So what was I thinking about when I made the first Bori Pri HaGafen? The mindfulness was extremely focused. What was it focused on to? 1 glass of wine. Because I know the second glass, I have to make another bracha for. When I made the second glass and made a bracha over it, what was I thinking about in all likelihood? The mitzvah. I just recited the whole Haggadah over matzah, over a glass of wine, and now I drink the glass of wine. What was I probably thinking about? I was probably thinking about that wine. Okay, so now the guy who wants to have another glass after his first two glasses, before he has matzah, got to wet his lips for matzah. Or, I'm very uncomfortable. I need to loosen up a little. I need another glass of wine. Does he make another brach? So, on the surface, it seems yes. But the problem is, if you make another bracha, it looks like you have your own religion, where you drink five glasses of wine. Because we never make a bracha when you drink additional glasses. Since you're making an additional borah per agafen, says this guy made five agafens. Wow, he's got a new religion. He's more religious than everybody else. I once bought a hat I was in New York a couple of years ago, and I was carrying matzah with me on the plane, and I didn't have room for a hat box. So I just wore two hats, which apparently looked very strange to people. So I stop at customs, and the guy is like, "Oh, you must be really religious. You wear two hats." He said, "He's so frum. He drinks five glasses of wine at the night of Pesach." And then you know how these rumors start. He says, "I was once at the rabbi's house, and they drink five glasses." So you think, we're supposed to drink five glasses. He didn't tell us. But really, really, really from people drink five glasses. And next thing you know it, a new tribe emerges of the five glass a night seders people. So therefore, we're not allowed to do that. That's called nira kimoysef al takonas chachamim. It looks like you're adding to the sages. You're not supposed to add to the takana, to the injunction of the sages. The sages made a certain institution for everybody to follow, and we don't tamper with that. So what's the solution? How can you have your extra glass of wine? And I know this happens. I know people drink at the Seder. I don't advise it, but I know people do this. What do you have to do it right? You have to have in mind when you made the second Borei Pri Hagafen that you were going to drink extra wine. So you have to have that extra mindfulness. Because if you didn't have the extra mindfulness, you're going to have to make another bracha. And making another bracha is profoundly problematic. You got that? It actually makes sense. Okay? If you wouldn't talk about this, you wouldn't know it. So now you know what you need to do. If you want to have your extra l'chaim before the matzah, then you must have in mind, you don't have to verbalize it, but you have to have in mind when you make hagafen that you're planning to drink additional wine. Okay. Now let's go back to Kiddush. So you recited Kiddush, and you drank the glass of wine. You leaned as you were supposed to. Very nice. Beautiful. What's next? So before I tell you what's next, you know what's next, but let me just throw something out there. We have a mitzvah tonight, right? What's the big mitzvah of the night? Besides the eating and drinking, what's the big mitzvah of the night? Telling the story. What's the best way to communicate when you want to give something to somebody else, trying to pass on an idea? What's the best way, most effective way to do it? It should be interactive. Today, good educators talk about creating an interactive classroom. It wasn't like that. It used to be children should be seen, not heard, and if they squirmed, they got the stick, the strap, and the birch. But we don't believe in that anymore today. Here's a little secret. Our sages never believed in that. In fact, the Torah ordains that in this big night of education, because Pesach is about education, that how should we tell the story? We should tell the story as a response to a question. Because if you're just doing a monologue, you're just throwing stuff at the kid is not particularly excited. Okay, you can make it interesting. But what's the best way to make it interesting for the child? If he actually precipitated your explanation with a question. Because then it's his thing, not your thing. So what's our order of business now? What do we want to accomplish? We want to get the kid to ask questions. We need to get him to ask questions. Because when he starts to ask questions, it's funny you should ask. You know what? Let me tell you about it. What's the famous verbiage for this question? Ma nishtana halayla hazeh. What's going on tonight? Hey, mom, hey, dad, what are we doing tonight? Why are things different? Ah, my dear, why are things different? Let me tell you a story. Once upon a time. So we need to get the children to ask questions. So what will we do to get the children to ask questions? Well, let me say it a little differently. What does anybody do when you want people to ask questions? Besides say, aren't you going to ask me a question? What would you do? You do things that are unusual. If you do things that are unusual, people will notice you're doing something unusual, and they might say, why are you doing that? And then once they say, why are you doing that, you have them exactly where you wanted them, receptive, ready to hear an answer. So we should do funny things for the children. So should you wear two hats at the table? So the child says, Dad, why are you wearing two hats? The answer is, not really. Why? Because the question is not supposed to come out of just doing narishkeit or silly things. The question is supposed to come because we're doing something halachic, something which has Yiddishkeit etiquette to it, but it's not something we do all year. That's the kind of question. Understand? The question itself should be born out of not just frivolity, because otherwise it's just a frivolous question. Hey, Dad, why are you acting like a weirdo? Ah, my son, you know why I'm acting like a weirdo? Because I have a story to tell you. So the kid thinks, what's his entrance into it? My dad's acting weird, and he wants me to ask questions. Why is he acting weird? But I don't really know why he's acting weird, and I know it's weird, but I'm not going to tell him that I know it's weird. So we have to do something which actually has come with a halachic explanation, because at the Seder, there's nothing which is extraneous or extra. What happens in every single Jewish home after Kiddush on Friday night? What's the next thing? What do we do next? Friday night. What happens? We wash. We wash our hands. Okay. So what should we do on the night of Pesach? We go wash our hands. And that's actually what happens. We have Kaddish. What's the next thing? Urchatz. Okay. And then what happens after we wash our hands? Then we reach for a little vegetable. And we dip the vegetable. We do what's called karpas. We dip the vegetable in salt water. And then we make a bracha. And then we nibble it. And then we put it down. And that's really weird. Because the kid thinks, look, this is late. It's really late. We don't even usually do this. Look at it. It's like night outside now. And we finally made Kiddush. Okay. We're leaning when we drink. I don't know, I'm sure why we're doing that, but okay. And then in addition, we finally go to wash our hands, and I'm hungry. And instead of eating, we nibble. And then we finish nibbling, push it on the side. And what do we do afterwards? Then the child sees us reaching for the matzah. He goes, okay, all right, fine. So there was some nibbling, but now we're going to do the eating, because we're going to do the eating. And what do? We take the matzah and we break it, which is like the equivalent of cutting the challah, and kids think that's kind of normal. And then what do? And then we push the Seder plate aside, and we pour a second glass of wine. At this point, the child explodes. What's going on over here? Manashtana halayla azah. That's exactly what Manashtana said. When is Manashtana recited? After yachatz, after the matzah is broken, and after we pour the second glass of wine. You get the rhyme and reason? Okay, so let me now explain to you the business of washing your hands to dip a vegetable into salt water. Why do we wash our hands before we eat bread? It has nothing to do with hygiene. That's the hint. Why do we do this? So the simple reason is because in temple times, our sages ordained that yadayim, that hands, should have the halachic status of shniim l'tuma, which means second level ritual impurity. What does that mean practically? So practically, in the Holy Land, which is holy because, in part because that which grows from it is sacred and has mitzvahs done with it, when the farmer would harvest the products, the produce, the grain, what would he do? He would separate 2% and give that to the Kohen. And that's known in Hebrew as truma. The word truma means to lift off or to separate. What happens to the truma food? The truma food is sacred. And therefore, it has to be eaten by people of a special class. Those people are called Kohanim. The Kohanim have to be in a state of ritual purity. If a non-Kohen eats Truma, it's a grave sin. It's like eating Chametz on Pesach. Bad idea. If a Kohen who is ritually impure eats Truma, it's also a sin. And lastly, if the Truma is impure, then the Kohen eating it is committing a sin. How could it become ritually impure? Well, much like anything else could become ritually impure. Either it's under a common enclosure with certain kinds of impurity, like, for example, a corpse, or it touches. It physically touches something which is impure. Now, our hands are busy. Yodayim askoni yaseim, say the sages. We touch things all the time without realizing it. Today, we recognize that in the form of hygiene. That's why when you walk into a hospital, what are people constantly doing? They're pressing the thing and they're rubbing their hands. Why do you have to rub your hands? Because people touch their ears, they touch their nose, they touch their eyes. They're always touching. People are touchy. That's the way people are. And because we're always touching without even noticing, if you're in a situation where there's lots of germs, it's a good idea to constantly wash your hands from germs. But we're not talking about germs here. We're talking about ritual impurity. You don't know who you touched. You don't know what you touched. So your hands are deemed to be shniyos, second-grade ritual impurity. Practically speaking, who will that affect? It can only affect the teruma food. The teruma food can become ritually impure if hands, which are impure, touch them. So in order to touch that kind of bread, what do you need to do? You need to lave your hands ritually, which is called netilat yodayim. The netilat yodayim, after being performed, that allows you to touch the bread. So you're saying, well, that's nice, but I'm not a Kohen, I don't need truma. Why do I have to wash before I eat the bread? And the answer simply is that truma bread doesn't look different than any other bread. And the only way for us to ensure that the truma bread doesn't become ritually impure, which would have to be incinerated, by the way, and wasted, which would be a terrible shame. The only way to make sure that happens is by ordaining that we don't touch bread ever unless we first wash our hands for netilat yadayim. That's the reason for netilat yadayim. It's a rabbinic mitzvah. Now, there is an opinion in the Mishnah that says not only we should be concerned with bread, we should also be concerned with dabar shetibuli b'mashka, with a vegetable or a fruit which has become moistened, that also would become susceptible to ritual impurity. And so, according to this opinion, if you ever reach into a pickle, a jar of pickles, take out a pickle, what should you do first? You should ritually wash your hands without a bracha. There are many, by the way, who do this. The Rambam says it has to be done. Al Tareb actually rules like that. So, without a bracha, but if you're going to touch wet or moist fruits or vegetables, first you're going to perform netilat yadayim. You follow what I'm saying? Most people do not do this for fruits and vegetables. When do they do this? Bread. And that's the halacha. On the night of Pesach, our sages came up with a brilliant idea. Tonight, we're going to make everybody holy rollers. Everybody's going to be super frum. They're going to wash their hands to touch a vegetable. So it's not like we're doing something ridiculous. It actually has halachic basis. We're touching a vegetable. Why are we touching the vegetable? Because we have to eat it. And because we want to make sure that it should be, we should wash our hands for it, we dipped it into the brine or salt water. And because we dipped into the brine or salt water, we have to make sure we wash our hands, which gives the child pause, because everything kind of looks normal, but it really isn't. He saw you go to wash your hands, you didn't make a bracha. He saw you dip the vegetable in the brine. You nibbled, then you reached for the bread. You broke the bread, but didn't eat the bread. And now you're pouring another glass of wine. Gewalt, manishtana halayla hazeh, he exclaims. What is going on over here tonight? You understand the rhyme and reason? And even if there are no children at the table, and even if there's nobody to be impressed, and even if the children have been learning about this in school from the day after Purim, it doesn't matter. That's what we do. That's the Seder. That's the order. Which leads us into two extremely important points. Point number one. It is common at many Seder tables of people who don't know these halachas that they eat a lot of celery sticks. Do you know why they eat a lot of celery sticks? Because they're very hungry. Because that's all they're being served now. And you know, these days it's healthy, so what? Celery sticks and salt water is not so bad. So and when you're hungry, anything will do. So they do a lot of karpas. But that's actually not correct according to halacha. And here's how it goes. In Torah literature, whenever there's achila, whenever there is eating required, we always have to eat a shear. Eating a shear means eating the right amount. There's an amount, a modicum amount, what's called a serving. So when you want to know how many calories something has, it will say calories per serving. Then there's these deceptive bottles of seltzer with fruit stuff mixed in. It says 0 calories per serving, but they forgot to tell you that the serving is only 2 ounces. And you think it's zero calories, but haha, they got you, because really when you drank the whole bottle of seltzer, you did get yourself 6 calories. Okay, so they're very smart. You look at the thing, it's 0 calories per serving. Everything works by servings. So whenever we want to look at something, see the ratio or the caloric content or whatever, somebody always follows servings. It's an old idea. In halacha, we follow servings. What's the amount of a serving according to halacha? It's called a kizayit. Kizayit literally means like an olive. The size of an olive, only apparently the olives once upon a time were significantly larger than the olives we have today. So the amount, the size of an olive for the record, according to most halachic opinions, is an ounce. It's an ounce. How much matzah, for example, do you have to eat on the night of Pesach to fulfill the mitzvah? An ounce. An ounce of matzah is not this much matzah because it's a very thin cracker. It's closer to half a matzah, a little less than half a matzah. Depending on the thickness of the matzah, some matzah is thicker, some is thinner, but it's usually going to be a little bit less than half a matzah, somewhere between a third and a half a matzah. You're going to eat maror. How much maror should you eat? An ounce. How much karpas should you eat? Less than an ounce. Why? Whenever you eat things in a halachic setting, how much should you eat? How much should you eat? A kezias. So this is the minority report. This is the one halachic eating, which is actually not about eating. This is about nibbling. So if somebody says, is there ever a mitzvah to nibble? The answer is once a year. Which is the nibbling you do? You nibble the karpas. You don't eat the karpas, you nibble it. So you're saying, well, I don't get it. Why can't I just have some celery, like I'm hungry? Or some people serve potato or parsley. Why can't I have a little, why can't I eat a little? So now it gets even more interesting. What bracha do we make over the karpas? What bracha do we make? Hadama. Why? Because it's a vegetable. Now, there are as many customs of what we use for the karpas. Celery stick is very common today. Parsley is common in parts of Germany. In Poland, they didn't have celery. In Russia, the Ukraine, White Russia, if you came around the end of March, beginning of April, there was no way you were getting celery there. Or if it was available, you couldn't afford it. But what was there plentifully and available? Potatoes or onions. Exactly. So a lot of the Polish and Russian Jews, their tradition is to take potatoes and onions. Now, there's this thing, it has to be a green vegetable, but it's not really true. It doesn't matter if it's green or white or yellow. The point is it should be a vegetable. Why does it need to be a vegetable? Why can't we use like dried apricots or something? Maybe figs or dates. The answer is that much later on in the Seder, after we eat the matzah, we're going to be eating the maror. The maror is the bitter herbs. What is the maror? A vegetable. So here is the halachic conundrum. When you wash your hands for hamotzi, you don't have to recite additional blessings during the course of the meal. Why? Because this is called dvarim haboyim machmat hasuda. The things that you're eating at the table are part of the meal. Since you washed, you broke bread, you washed for hamotzi, everything at the meal is included in the meal you're eating. So for example, it's Friday night. After your kiddush, you washed your hands, you made a motzi, and then the fish comes out. Do you have to make a bracha on the fish? Why not? What if it's sushi? Why don't you have to make a bracha? Because you made hamotzi already. Do you have to make a bracha on the chicken soup, on the knedlach? No. Why? You made hamotzi. Do you have to make a bracha on the brisket? No. Kugel? No. Dessert? Maybe. Why? It depends if dessert is considered to be part of the meal or something you do after the meal. And that's a subject for another day. But dessert is where we get into a question. So in other words, there could be something which is not really seen as part of the meal. And because it's not really part of the meal, so therefore, you might have to make a bracha over it. In other words, people who always eat dessert before Birchat HaMazon or always eat dessert as part of the meal, you always have dessert, then that would be considered part of the meal. Somebody who never really eats dessert, but on the rare occasion goes to a simcha and they serve some ice cream or they serve, then he eats dessert but doesn't usually do it, would have to make a bracha. My father told me that he was once at a wedding and he saw Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, the famous halachist of the most famous halachist of the 20th century, he saw him sitting down after the wedding and they were serving ice cream. So he wanted to see if Reb Moshe is going to make a bracha over the ice cream, because this is a big shaila in halacha. So Reb Moshe noticed my father looking at him. And he said to him, "It's not going to help you to look what I do." He said, "I'm a European. Europeans have different customs than Americans. I never really acclimatized myself. It's not going to help you to look what I do." It's interesting. Reb Moshe was so like caught on right away. I'm not here to talk to you about dessert, but I'm here to talk to you about the maror. Here's the question. Is the maror part of the meal? It could be argued. You washed for matzah. You knew you were going to have maror, and after maror, we can finally eat. It's only about midnight now. Right? But you have to eat maror first. Or maybe the maror is not really part of the meal. The maror is not like food. How do we look at the maror? It's a ritual. Somebody will see you eating maror and say, "Why are you eating that?" "I'm hungry." "No, give me a break. You're not eating that because you're hungry." "Okay, fine. I'm eating it because I'm ritually mandated to eat it." In other words, the maror is being eaten as a mitzvah, which now presents us with a question. Since it could be seen as part of the meal, it shouldn't require a bracha. Since it could be seen as not part of the meal, it should require a bracha. Okay, what should we do? So should you make a borer pri adama on the maror or not? It's a problem. By the way, making brachas that are not necessary is not cute. That's like saying Hashem's name in vain. So we have to be careful when there's a bracha which we weren't supposed to recite. We're actually not supposed to recite it. But the problem here is maybe you do have to make a bracha. Maybe this isn't included. Enter the solution. The Chachamim said you should make a bracha of borei pri ha'adama on a little tiny piece of vegetable called karpas. When you recite the bracha of ha'adama over the little piece of potato, onion, parsley, celery, whatever it may be, what are you thinking about? Remember, bracha is about mindfulness. What are you thinking about? You're thinking about the karpas, and you should also be thinking about the maror. So the ha'adama recited over the karpas works for the karpas, and it also works for the maror. Do you understand? Remember, I told you about brachas and mindfulness? You want to do this right? If you want to do this right, when you make the bracha, what should you be thinking about? The maror too. Now comes the next, like, halacha conundrum. If you eat enough to make an after blessing, should you recite an after blessing? Because after all, till you eat the maror is like a whole, like an hour and a half away. So have no fear, the Alter Rebbe says, because the Haggadah is both part of a process, but on the other hand, what if it is an interruption? So really, once I eat, if I'm not planning to eat more of something, I'm supposed to make an after blessing. When is the one time I don't recite a blessing after eating something? If you didn't eat enough to make a blessing, an after blessing. To nibble, you have to make a bracha rishona, a first blessing. But if you didn't eat a kazayit, you don't have to make the after blessing, which means that if you want to do this right, my friends, when you dip the karpas into the salt water and you make a bracha of borei pri ha'adama, you're thinking about the maror. You're not going to eat an ounce of it, because if you eat an ounce of it, perhaps you may have to recite an after blessing. And if you recite the after blessing, it no longer helps you with the maror. So the only way to do this right is to nibble. It's the only time of the year when it's a mitzvah to nibble and nothing else. You need to make that first bracha. You don't want to have to make that second bracha.
But you do say an after bracha already.
The after bracha we recite at the end of the meal incorporates everything, because that's what Birchat HaMazon does. But if you would have eaten already celery sticks like people eat, like they joke about, at the Seder, we eat like 50 celery sticks. And I cringe when they say that. They say, "Vei Yizmir." They don't know what they're doing. How could they know? Nobody taught them. That's why we're talking about this tonight. So you do the right thing. The right thing is to make a bracha of borei pri ha'adama and be thinking about the maror, not to eat enough to require an after blessing. Does that make sense? It's pretty clear. You see how it goes, like, there's like multiple concerns you have to be kind of thinking of. what brachas should apply and shouldn't apply. And this is why karpas is a key part of the Seder. Because number one, it accomplishes many things. It gets our children to ask questions. Number two, it's not just doing funny stuff. We're doing something which actually has a basis in halacha. But in addition to all of that, it allows us to have a bracha for the maror, which we don't know if we're supposed to make a bracha over it. We may have to recite a hadama. We may not have to recite a hadama. Because our sages made the karpas a part of the Seder, automatically they dealt with, they troubleshot for later on when you got to the maror, taken care of already. Your first hadama worked. You got that? So now we have gone through the halachic etiquette of what governs the kiddush, the washing of the karpas, the yachatz is basically break the matzah, the recitation of the haggadah, read what it says in the book. You get to the second glass, you recite halal, the first half of halal, you recite the special blessing, you drink your glass, second glass of wine leaning. Now you know that if you wanted more wine, you had to be thinking about it. And you know that when you made the bracha of the karpas, you had to have the hadama in mind. So we have done halachic etiquette from the beginning of the Seder all the way up to motzi matzah. In our next class, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to talk about motzi matzah, and then we're going to talk about Korach, because here, once again, it is fraught with halachic issues, concerns, and conundrums, which we will clarify so that you can do it right. You have a question?
Because this year it comes out on Friday night.
Yeah, Friday night.
So what do we do about challah instead of challah?
So instead of challah, you have matzah. The matzah becomes like challah.
So right after you wash your hands?
No. See, this is the thing. You're asking a really good question. Don't you have to have challah on Friday night? Yeah, of course you do. But it's Pesach, can't have challah, because you can have matzah. So when are you going to have the matzah? You'll have the matzah when you have the matzah. But here's the important part of your question. What were to happen if somebody would make a bracha when he washes his hands for urchatz? What if you make al natilat yadayim? You'd have to eat the bread. Some people want to make that mistake. No. You have to really be careful not to make the bracha, because if you make the bracha, then you have to follow through with the rest. And then your seder will be out of order. So you make that bracha, you wash your hands the first time, don't make a bracha. There's a lot of blessings that are yes and no, right? And mindful. You see, the Seder night is much about the brachas. The brachas are a key part. Remember, we talked about the hagafens. We talked about the bracha you don't recite over your hands. We talked about the hadama, the after blessing. We talked about the shechianu. It's a lot to do with the blessings. The blessings in the right time, in the right place, in the right intervals, so that we can do this right. And of course, the word bracha, incidentally, I promise you no philosophy, but I can't help myself. Bracha means hamshacha. Bracha means actualization. It means to bring down into our world. When we recite a bracha, we bring holiness into our realm. The bracha is the envelope of the convention that brings holiness into what we're doing. We infuse our activities with holiness when we recite a bracha before. So the brachas are really important. It's a very important part of the night. It's an important part of anything we do. And the bracha, as I said, is not just, or primarily not a verbalization, but really it's a contemplation. It's a meditation. The bracha is an act of profound mindfulness, meaningful mindfulness, which brings the Shechina, which brings Hashem's presence into our lives.
You had also mentioned grape juice as opposed to wine.
Yeah. So I really didn't go through that in detail. But here's the thing. Wine is a special beverage. Like, when you're serving wine, it's like it's not a regular lunch day. But grape juice is a common drink. And the difference between wine and grape juice is that grape juice can't become wine. It's killed. They kill the
bacteria,
the chemicals. They kill the yeast. So the only, if somebody is allergic to wine, they can't drink alcohol, what you could do is squeeze grapes just Erev Pesach, because then there's still a live fermenting agent there. The wine actually is bubbling. The grape juice is bubbling. That is a halachic loophole. So if somebody can't drink wine, buy yourself a juicer, wash the grapes, clean them, squeeze them, and you make yourself grapes. And that way, within 24 hours, it's still, so to speak, live. Leave it in the fridge after 24 hours, it dies. The yeast dies, unless it's carefully curated so that it should actually, start to ferment. So it has to either have fermented or be fermentable. So that's a very simple way around somebody who can't have alcohol. So it's true, we make a bori perigof on grape juice, but it's basically dead. It's dead wine, that's what it is. And part of what makes wine special is the wine. It has always been the drink of royalty, and it always bring the drink which is associated with faith or faith practice, what we call sacraments. And it's an amazing thing that despite the cultures and civilizations and the vicissitudes of time, it has remained such. Wine is still in a class of its own.
Yain Mavushal is also dead.
Yain Mavushal is dead. Yes. The Yain Mavushal, cooked wine, a wine which is pasteurized, can no longer ferment, but it's already fermented. That's the difference. Grape juice never fermented. They killed it before it fermented. They pasteurized it. Whereas this Yain Mavushal was already wine. There are some authorities that say you shouldn't be drinking Yain Mavushal, but this is a whole other subject of what's the virtues or vices of cooked wine, pasteurized wine or not. But the Yain Mavushal is exactly that. It is Yain. It is already wine. And because it is already wine, the pasteurization doesn't really affect the status of being wine. Whereas grape juice would.
Do you have to read the whole Haggadah, or can you leave out paragraphs here and there?
This is a very, very good question. Yeah. Do you have to read the whole Haggadah? I could not, as a rabbi, tell you the answer is, nah, do whatever you want. Couldn't tell. Let me phrase it to you differently. Should you read the whole Haggadah? Of course you should. You come to me and you say, if I didn't read the whole Haggadah, did I still fulfill the mitzvah? The answer is yes. So, do the best you could. Try to read as much of it as you could. Remember, everything in the Haggadah is sacred. We don't want to lose anything. We're supposed to, it says, called Hamar Belisaper. On this night, anybody who increases to speak, we're not supposed to decrease our speaking about the Haggadah, we're supposed to increase the speaking about the Haggadah. What I would say to you is, don't read it in Hebrew if it's very difficult. If it's onerous and meaningless, read it in English. Read the commentary. This is one night in which we shouldn't skimp. This is one night where we should spend the time, where we should increasingly speak as much as possible about the subject of the day, which is Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus.
Another question.
Yeah.
Maror has its own blessing.
Has its own blessing. Excellent question. So the answer is, since Maror in today's day and age is rabbinic, the mitzvah of eating Maror and its blessing would be rabbinic, much like the reading of the Megillah or the lighting of the Hanukkah menorah. Yeah? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
To be continued. So next week we'll continue with matzah, okay? We're going to talk about the matzah, and then the week after we'll talk about the maror and the korach, the sandwich. How that's done, why that's done, and so on and so forth. So make sure you do it right. Okay?